Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. Our subject this month is legendary TV producer Norman Lear, born in 1922 to parents whom he would later use as models for Archie and Edith Bunker. And after serving in World War II, Lear set out for a career in publicity, like his uncle. He moved to California to follow that path, but found his way to comedy writing in the early days of television. That eventually led to him creating his first TV show, 1959's The Deputy, starring Henry Fonda, which lasted two seasons. Always socially minded, in the late 1960s, he pitched a show about a blue-collar family, producing two failed pilots. A third pilot was picked up by CBS, and All in the Family premiered in January 1971. It had only mediocre ratings, but after it picked up numerous Emmy Awards, audiences found it via summer reruns, and when it returned for its second season, it became a ratings powerhouse, becoming the top-rated TV show for the next 5 years. This led to an extraordinary hot streak for Lear, who went on to create enduringly popular shows like Sanford and Son, Maude, The Jeffersons, Good Times, and One Day at a Time. He also created the show Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, a parody of soap operas in form and content, producing 325 daily episodes in just 2 years. Norman Lear, a TV showrunner, was so famous he even hosted Saturday Night Live in its second season. But in between all that, he dabbled in films, writing and producing 1967's Divorce American Style, and then writing and directing Cold Turkey in 1969. Concerned about its box office potential, the film was shelved until 1971. By then, Lear was on his way to becoming the most successful TV producer of all time. He would never direct a feature film again. Here with me to discuss the first and last film of Norman Lear is Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman cast member, journalist, and writer, Claudia Lamb. Hi, Claudia.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to always like to kind of pull back the curtain a little bit for people just jumping in here, is that Claudia and I got acquainted over on the former Bad Place. And I was really
the current Bad Place.
The current, yes, it is still the current Bad Place, but we are both no longer there. That's exactly why it's former for both of us. But I was so I really enjoyed talking to you back and forth, and I knew, of course, your connection to Norman Lear, who I always found to be an incredibly fascinating figure. I grew up in the 70s watching a lot of his shows, and there's just the idea of someone being this massively successful. Just it's unrivaled. We can talk about other TV producers and their reach nowadays, but none of them have the reach that Norman Lear had in the 70s. And for the longest time, I don't think I even knew that he had ever directed a feature film. I knew about Cold Turkey. I had seen it back in my video store days, but I didn't realize he directed it. And I was sort of kind of like, well, I really just want to talk to Claudia anyway. We'll contrive some reason to have her on. And then when I realized that, hey, Norman did direct a movie, his sole film, well, this is perfect. So that's why we're going to be here to talk about Cold Turkey and, of course, your interactions with Norman, because you spent a lot of time with him. As I mentioned, you were on 325 episodes of Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman.
Yes, I was.
A staggering amount of films. I mean, so, again, we're going to talk about the film and all this other stuff, but I really wanted to kind of talk to you a little bit about just how you got started in all this. Like, how did you decide to want to become an actor in the first place, a child actor in the first place?
So I do want to correct the record. It's 325 episodes of Mary Hartman and another 130 episodes of Forever Fernwood,
right, yes.
Which is what they called the show after Louise left. So that was 455 half-hour shows in like 28 months.
That's one of the questions I have for you, which is how? How were that much television produced?
For me, it was I needed to work, and for the adults, a lot of that show operated on caffeine and cocaine. What? The 1970s, come mm-hmm. on. And there were several people who were not like up to their eyeballs in drugs, and they were like great touchstones and people for me, you know, that, but otherwise there was a lot of really crazy. I'm not saying you know, there were lions on the table, but it was the 70s and people would leave work and, you know, until, you know, wee hours of the morning and roll into their office or, you know, dressing room, some of them temporarily, and like sleep it off for a few hours and then like do a show and go back out. That was the age of a lot of Bolivian marching powder. So,
As it's so euphemistically called.
yes. Nose candy, all the different terms for it. But the show itself was 28, well, for Mary Hartman, you know, we first started rehearsals. I think it was the November 8th, 1975, and we had last meeting and the first, last, and only read-throughs we ever had. Because we never had time. What? Read-throughs? Seriously? There was never time for that after that. We had time between the middle of November. We had, I think it was 2 weeks before we started taping. And then it was just 5 days a week. And then we had enough in the can for it to premiere in January of 76. And it was so unusual that with the premiere of it comes this Norman talking about it, like, hey, you know, this is something you've never ever seen before. So yeah, I remember on being on the interview, and you know, when you have a good interview, and I knew that they liked me and they had me do the side a couple of times, and that was really great. And then they asked me if I had any other interviews to be on that afternoon, and if my mom and I had time to watch the pilot. And the pilot was two episodes, so, or the, you know, pilots. And I remember going into this really chilly room because of the time of year it was November. Anyhow, we watched these two pilots, and I think they wanted to make sure that my mom wasn't going to go, oh, hell no. No. And, you know, frog marched me out, never to be, you know, because they. So I remember my mom saying, it's throwing me off without the laugh track. I don't know when to laugh, which turned out to be exactly what Norman wanted.
Right.
That's exactly what he wanted. And that was a Wednesday. And on Thursday, I got a call back and someone for to call my agent. And I have written most of my memoirs, and I could go on again on and on about, you know, being a child actor. I was in trouble because I was getting a D in my math class in pre-algebra, and that put my California work permit at jeopardy. And the California work permit was the be all and the end all. And I was in very big trouble, and my mom had beaten hell out of me. And I've been in my room trying to figure out, like, okay, this has got to be. Now, I never had time to do homework often because as I got into middle school, because I was always going on interviews. And when I was in elementary school, there wasn't any homework. So that was never an issue going on all the interviews. And you asked before how I came to be in the business. I did my first job when I was three, and one of my other brothers had been approached by a photographer who wanted to use him in a calendar, and my brother ended up doing quite a bit of work. And my mom dragged me along and had pictures taken at Sears, and she, you know, I was 3 years, well, she was actually trying to get me work when I was two and a half. And
Wow.
me being the slacker that I am, I was three before I landed my first gig. So, and there's not a child in the universe that chooses at that age to do that. You know, anybody can say, but you always wanted to do it. I always wanted chocolate cake for dinner. Doesn't mean that's good for me.
Right.
And when you present it to a child as, do you want to be on TV? Well, yeah. And that they don't say is, do you want to be a social outcast? Do you want to have people treat you like you did something wrong? Do you want teachers to be angry at you and take it out on you? And the, you know, those are some of the negative parts. And then the positive parts where I made a really good paycheck that my parents stole. And there was no Coogan law for commercial work. So my parents pushed me into tons and tons and tons of commercial work. And by the time I got on to Mary Hartman, I had done 55 commercials
Wow.
between the age of 3 and 11. But let's shave that down even a little more. I didn't do my first commercial until I was 5. But by the time I was 7, I had my SAG and my AFTRA union card. And I was just working, working, working. So when it came to me not being able to get the math down, this was in November of middle school when I had gone from elementary school to middle school. Now, in the 7 months before I started just after Labor Day. And in the time between Labor Day, so it'd be 9 months, sorry, first of the year in Labor Day, I had done 5 commercials. There I was. I had done just work upon work upon work, and I went on this interview, and I knew I had nailed it. And the next day, so that was the Wednesday, and then here's the Thursday, and I come home, and I've got my report card, and my mom beats hell out of me because that's what she did. She beat hell out of me. And because there were times I really just like, I don't want to work. Then she comes into my bedroom and she's all really super excited. And I can't tell if she's going to hit me again or if she's happy. And she's like, oh God, you're supposed to be over the hill right now. You're supposed to be in Norman Lear's office right now. And I was like, oh my gosh. So we peel out and try to go, and it's rush hour traffic and it takes more than an hour to get over the hill to get to his office. And my mom like won't shut up. I'm supposed to do this. And she'd always give me these really, really long notes about how I was supposed to go in on any given interview, and I would ignore it the instant I got in there. And that's how I got all the work. And we go in there, and it's like they rush me across the lot, and I get up there, and it's dark. It's like 6:30 at night, and I know these people have been waiting at least. I don't know how long they've been waiting for me. Like I said, there was a screw up. Someone didn't call my agent. So there we were. And it was Norman Lear and Al Burton, who was also a titan in the industry, and casting folks and Louise. I ran through the piece and I did it once. And got ready to do it again, and they're like, thanks, you can go. Just like, what just happened? And I'm walking to the door, like, the green mile, like, oh God, she's gonna kill me. She's gonna kill me. I really thought I had this. And we're walking down the hall to the elevator, and it's dead silent. And my mom's just like not saying a word, and I could feel the anger coming off of her. And I hear the door open, and Al Burton says, "Claudia, would you wait up a minute?" And I was like, "Oh, you're kidding!" And he came down, and he said, "How would you like to be Heather Hartman?" And I was like, "Oh!" And I could honestly say that was the only time in my life I could remember my mom being proud of me. And I say that with a question mark because I don't even know if she had the capability of being proud of anyone else. She was just a flaming narcissist. But at least being on that show bought her not doing any more body blows or direct face hits. So there was that. Yay for me. But that was Thursday night. And that was the last, like, I went, that was my life changed on a dime. In like 48 hours. And actually, it was even closer to 38 hours. And there I am, and we're going home. And they're like, okay, you need to be on lot tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, chop, chop. And then it was like, oh no, 8 o'clock, because you need to do school, because I need you to do 3 hours of school every day. And that Friday, the teacher was pretty decent about not asking too much out of me because we had to do like physicals for insurance. And then we all had this luncheon down on the stage, and Norman had Chasen's cater it, which was an old Beverly Hills. Yeah, you've heard of
Oh,
Chasen's.
sure.
So,
Yeah, a fancy ritzy restaurant, sure.
right. Yeah. And then after lunch, we all had to go hair and wardrobe. And as each of us, like I was basically me. The picture you see of us, where I'm in that like checked shirt, that was one of my interview shirts. I had like interview clothes that I would go on. It was jeans and the checked shirt and the braids, and those were my glasses. So there wasn't a whole heck of a lot we needed to do for wardrobe. It's the same outfit that I wore to the interview and the callback. And my mom washed them like Thursday night because they were wrinkly as, like they were dirty and they had gone into the laundry, and we had to pull them out and throw them in the dryer with like a towel to try to fluff them up. So, before I went back over the hill. So I got to watch as everybody, I got into makeup first because I was in wardrobe first, and I got to watch as everybody came out dressed in their character. And we were like laughing and joking. And as each new person came out, we were getting like more and more, it was kind of frenetic and silly because we were all like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. And we did our pictures. And the one thing I can say is about Norman is at his office, the picture behind his desk at his home office was us. It was a giant picture of Mary Hartman, of the cast picture we took that day. And he was standing on the other side of the camera. He wasn't the one taking the pictures, but he was there, and that was what we were all doing. And he, that of all the shows that he put in, he had, I think it was seven hit shows on at one time at the same time.
It's unreal. It's
Yeah,
unreal.
it's like, yeah, the top 10, he had seven of them, and it was like, what? And or it was six of them and us, because we were like, Nielsen was like, I don't know.
Right, because you guys were Mayor
Carmen,
Hartman was
right?
syndicated, right? There was it
Right.
wasn't the same, yeah,
Right.
standard.
It wasn't the same thing. It was there was no metric on that, but it was a screaming hit, and on the cover of Time, on the cover of Rolling Stone, that. But so that day, we finished, we go home, and they hand all of us 3 weeks worth of scripts, and we started rehearsing on Monday morning. Like, we had the weekend off, and then it was like nose to the grindstone for a couple of years. And when we were filming Mary Hartman, the word hiatus did not mean you've been canceled. It wasn't a fancy term for saying you've been canceled. It was literally the rest period.
Right.
And we did the first 130 episodes of Mary Hartman. That was season one. And we cut out. I
130
know.
episodes of season
I know.
one. Nowadays, TV shows do six, right?
Right.
Like your favorite
Yeah.
show on streaming does
We
six
did that.
shows.
Yeah.
Wow.
When we wanted to, we were all like, we absolutely needed. So we had hiatus that first year in 76. And then we came back in August and started putting stuff in the can, for the fall season. And somebody figured out that nobody planned on us taking time between Christmas and New Year. Like, there wasn't going to be, like, no, we literally can't, And so what we did was, starting December 1st, we did two shows a day for 10
Oh,
days. We did 10 shows in 2 weeks.
I mean, how were you able to do? I mean,
Do you
there
remember
had
the
to
part
be
about
labor laws
cocaine
for
and caffeine?
children.
Oh yeah, for me. But I was going to say, do you remember the part about cocaine and caffeine? I told you that.
Right, but
That's how
that's
they get.
I'm hopefully that 8-year-old
So,
you was not we're not doing
oh no,
was not
no.
doing
So
bumps in Louise Lasser's
I know, really. That's yeah, I
dressing
know.
room, Claudia, for God's sakes.
I did it right. I was doing bumps at 11. Come on.
Oh my God.
No, I was 11 when I started the show, and we started rehearsals, and about a month later I had my birthday, and then I was 12, and we worked until I was 14. For me, I had a very great teacher. She was really, really awesome. And on the days that I wasn't filming, on the few days that I wasn't, we would bank an hour or two. And then on those days where it was really hard on me with all the, like those 2 weeks, we didn't do school. We already had it in the bank. It was already done. And by the time I got done with a year in school, I was so much farther ahead than
Oh,
anybody
wow.
that I knew because I had a really good teacher and I liked learning. And it wasn't like I know a lot of my peers. I'm thinking of a couple of them who weren't fans of reading or learning, and they just didn't like. They didn't get a whole lot of book learning done, and they didn't get a whole lot of common sense. And I feel very bad for them because I had a great teacher, and I had a few bad ones before we got the good one, and she was life changing for me, and taught me to think ahead, to after when the, like maybe when the show was done, and maybe what I wanted to do when I was an adult, and that type of stuff, subtly being like, hey, this is does not have to be your life if you don't want it to be. And she was great. So she would always make sure that we had, I had plenty of time banked up. And otherwise, it was 2 weeks of just push, 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 so you could be dead for the next 2 weeks. You know, it was a lot of, I felt bad for a lot of the adults when I look back on it, how much they almost, a lot of them gave up with their family. Family tie, everybody, because for me, the earliest I could come in was 8 o'clock in the morning, unless there was special dispensation, and there was nobody coming in at that time. There was no nothing going on at that time, so that was when I would go in and start school. And rehearsals usually started around 10, but they had to get started earlier and earlier because as the show went on, Louise was getting more and more ragged, and it was harder and harder for her to be in every scene. So, yeah, so what I guess that I'm thinking about it now, sometimes if it was a really big day, they would be on, the call sheet would be for 8:30, and by the time I would come strolling down at 10 o'clock, they should have gone through a couple of scenes. And so it ended up where they had to call me because I'd go down there, it'd be like, okay, I'm supposed to be on set at 10 o'clock. And I'd go on, go down there. 10 o'clock would be, and they'd be agonizing through some scene and they would miss my window and I had to go back to school. So we had to come up with a thing where they would call me about 5 minutes before I was needed, and it would have to be after 10 o'clock. And there were certain, and Joan was like, she's not a dog. You can't just, we're in the middle of learning, and sometimes she had to say, I'm sorry, she can't come down now. You're going to have to wait 20 minutes. Because we're in the middle of something, and she would not sacrifice my education for their poor time management. And I would go down.
That's extraordinary. That's an amazing thing that she felt she had the power to do that, because she wasn't your mother, she was your teacher, but she had the presence of mind to be able to say that. That had to be difficult.
Yes. And it also taught me about boundaries and about self-worth and not allowing people to walk on you type things. We would, like I said, it'd take like 5 minutes to get down there, and we would rehearse, and depending on how many scenes I was in, I might be able to get another hour in before lunch, or I would take lunch early and do hair and makeup, and it really, really a lot of it depended upon how well things went after they went back to school. How well. So we would rehearse in the morning. At 1 o'clock, we would block and tape. So each scene would be block tape, block tape. So instead of blocking all of it out and then taping, because I was like, I turned into a pumpkin at 5, and they had to have special dispensation for me to be on set after 5 p.m. And that dispensation oftentimes wasn't granted same day. It had to be like, hey, we know that we're going to be. We have all these things to do, and then it would have to be approved by the office downtown, the same people who certified the teachers and gave us our work permits. And they didn't want to ever encourage any production company to lean on the children to make up for their lack of time management. So
Of
that's what
course.
Joan, right. No, they were like they were God in the law, you know. And
Yeah.
5 o'clock, I turned into a pumpkin,
Right.
and they didn't even want me on set at 5 o'clock. They're like, "And you're gone."
Right. Were your friends or your schoolmates even really aware of your strange circumstances? Because it's not like 8-year-olds are watching Mary Hartman, Mary Harmon. So they're
No,
not
and
really
again,
seeing what you're doing.
I was 11 when we started, and I was 12 when we went to air.
Okay.
So there's a huge difference between 8-year-old
Well,
and a
that's
12
true.
year old.
That's true. That's true. But
And
I
the
mean,
show
tw
made, yeah, the show made a
we're.
huge splash. And my neighbors, like I remember the neighbor kids being like parroting lines that I said back to me. And
Wow.
sometimes kids can be like really, really not very nice, but like I still talk. Several of the kids that weren't very nice to me, I'm, you know, bygones are bygones on Facebook, because when I look back on it, I'm like, nobody was teaching them how to be nice. You know, their parents were not nice people. So it's, you know, you don't expect more from children than what their parents can possibly teach them.
Right.
And that's where I'm lucky. Again, I had a lot of people who were very kind to me. They were very good to me. And like Dodie took me to my first Dodie was Dodie Goodman, who played my grandmother, Martha Shumway. And she took me to my first play. I got to see Annie. And back when Annie was, you know, wow, big tickets to have. And Victor Killian was very kind to me. And the prop master used to, like, when he'd go get stuff from the store, he'd buy me some kind of treat, you know, and it might be like peaches or strawberries and cream, or maybe it was bubble gum or something. And he'd be like, "Hey, it's in the prop room, go find it." And I'd be like a little monkey running around and, you know, climbing up to the ceiling, like, "What's here?" You know, and it might be baseball cards or, you know, whatever. And that was such a sweet, sweet thing to do. And that was Harold, the prop man. And I'm very, very fortunate that, again, there were a lot of adults who could see what was happening to me. My mom was a terrifically unpleasant woman, just really, really not pleasant. And at one point, she got herself banned to my dressing room for it was her time out. You know, she was just not like I said, she was just not a so people could see that what she was, and people tried to make it up and tried to be very kind to me, and I appreciate that. Those kindnesses are not lost on me. And I think that's part of the reason why I was able to, I won't say avoid the pitfalls of what for a lot of former child actors have, because I think if you scratch a former child actor, there's a group of us and we call ourselves formers. If you scratch a former, you're likely to find someone who has body issues, body image issues. You are likely to find someone who does not know how to handle money. We were all like, "No, it's none of your business. Just give me a paycheck. Just give it to me." You know, we had no choice on that. You know, and so many young performers grow up and they realize, "Oh my God, I've been taken advantage of," and then they have trust issues. So you scratch a little deeper, and you define trust issues in almost 100% of formers. And like I said, a lot of them don't know how to handle money, and they don't have an idea about how to plan for the future. And I'm not even going to go into how many formers had drug and alcohol issues.
Right, sure.
I mean, that's a trope and a
Yeah,
joke
it's
at
a
this point.
cliche, right?
It's
Yeah.
a cliche. Thank you. It's not a joke, it's a cliche. Because it's the same thing as stage monsters. I mean, stage mothers. There's a reason why they have a bad reputation.
Right.
And there's a reason why former child actors, and I won't just say actors, it'll be performers, it'll be singers and gymnasts and anybody else who was forced into something that they may have been very good at when they were young. But we're not wasting our potential if we wait until we're old enough to say maybe drive to the interview.
Right,
You
right.
know, you're not wasting any God-given talent. If it's a God-given talent, then it'll still be there when they can legally sign a contract.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
being a child actor, I'm going to lay something on you. The legal definition of being trafficked is being forced to work and not getting the money. So that particular definition was given to me by my dear friend Marcus, who played Jimmy Joe De Jeter in Mary Hartman. He played the little the young Reverend Jimmy Joe Jeter, and he and I are thick as thieves, and we've known each other. I've known him since he was four, and my mom told his mom how to get an agent and how to get into the business. And I've apologized to him so many times. I'm like, I'm so sorry, but the whole thing with being a child actor when we were both kids is that the Coogan Law really only puts a small percentage of it away, and then the rest of it can be taken. But there we didn't even have that great a protection.
Wow.
And my parents basically stole $1 million from me. So I thank my lucky stars that I got out of California when I was 20, and I moved to Colorado, and I made a whole different life. For a while, I was a stand-up comic. There was a bunch of us comics that were at a radio station, and the program director, the PD, he asked, like, hey, you want to come back? Like Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for an hour a day, and I ended up getting more and more time. And then it's so funny when you're young, you don't understand how ballsy you can be. And I reached out to KOA, which was this huge, the biggest radio station between New York and LA. And I'm like, hey, I'm free if you want me to work for you. And the guy was like, I gotta meet you. I ended up getting a job with him, and if you can't imagine, I have a gift for gab. And I was a talk show host while they still hired women and people that didn't spit poison. And when I could see the writing on the wall, and for a while I was a traffic reporter because those were really, really regular hours, and I could raise a kid. I got married, had a kid, got divorced. Raised the kid, and I love my son to pieces. It's so crazy to think he'll be 38 this year. I'm like, I know I'm 38, right? I'm 38. And then I went into news reporting, and I was an anchor for a while for a CNN affiliate, and then I got the job up at KGO in San Francisco, where my mentor, the person who originally hired me, I gotta see this person. He was the boss there. He left Denver and ended up being the boss there for a very long time. So for me, going to work there was about the height, and that was the height of my reporting. And I became a producer. I produced the news. And I always forget, is it four Edward R. Murrows and five Mark Twains, or four Mark Twains and five Edward R. Murrows national awards, APs? And that was just the height of it. Was such an honor to work for that station. And then it was purchased by a venture capital company, and they came in and they parted it out, and they sold every last piece, and they laid off all the good reporters. And that's why reporting sucks, is because basically five companies own all the media. and they absolutely control the message. And they laid off anybody, again, that wasn't spitting venom. And I feel really lucky because I got into radio in the late 80s and I managed to ride that wave until the teens. And that was a big deal for me. And I am so sad to see what my former business used to be. But
Yeah,
that's
well,
another story.
yeah, well, as we say, corporatization of media has just so not been a problem. Luckily, we've solved all that. It's all
Yes, we have.
smooth sailing from now on, everybody.
Oh my God. Yeah, we
Now,
got it all figured out.
you stayed in touch with Norman Lear this whole all your whole life, right? Because I remember when he passed away last year at 101, God bless him, 101, you posted a picture of yourself with him. I assume relatively recently. So you stay touch with him through all those decades?
There were, times when I didn't, but I last got to hug him. It was 2016, and then there was, you have just you always have the intention of, hey, we're going to go back, and then something happens like COVID. Those things that you put off, you can't go back, and COVID was that time. And then he used to post all the time during COVID on Twitter, before Twitter and Facebook were, just like open sewers. And I personally believe that Norman hung on until Henry Kissinger died.
He wanted to make sure.
He's gonna go proverbially piss on his grave because that man created so much havoc, caused, he's a mass murderer, and Norman was pretty up that and that, the Mike, also known as Meathead in All in the Family, was he was everything from the Greek Chorus to Jiminy Cricket. Like, no, it's not, he would argue with Archie about current events. And of
Right.
course, I don't know how All in the Family would, I don't see how it could possibly be done in this day and age.
Oh no, not at all. It is amazing. I mean, I do a whole separate podcast about MASH because it's my favorite TV show of all time, and we talk about it all the time on that show. That show, of course, which ran concurrently with All in the Family, and really owes its existence, not its existence, but its success to All in the Family because. Like All in the Family, it was a flop in its first season, and then it
Right.
got put behind All in the Family on Saturday nights, and it took off like a rocket because all of a sudden America.
I see also Cheers, things that had enough time to develop. And right now it's like the thing that they didn't bury, where it's like, wait, I'm not trending on the front page anymore. And it's like, not the right people watched you. So
But
yeah.
that's right. And so that's something we talk about on that show is that MASH has been grandfathered in because it's 50 years old and it's part of the pop culture history. But if it aired today, it would be ripped apart by so many different factions of people for its politics that it would just be it would be crushed under the weight of all that when it just didn't have to deal with that. And the same thing with all of Norman shows. I mean, I wanted to just give people a context about just the enormous reach that he had in the 70s. So let's talk a little bit like
All
five
in the
of
Family. Okay, All in the Family, Maude, The Jeffersons, Sanford and Son,
and One Day at a Time, all on the air
One
at the
Day at a
same time.
Time, all at the same time, and there's one more, and then Us. And at some point, I'm going to shout it out like it's my safe word, and I'll remember it. I'll remember what that sixth one is. And it's like, it's you'd think I'd remember, but dang, he did so much work. Oh. This is how much work Norman did. The last time I saw him, my husband and I went out to the Sony lot. They were doing the One Day at a Time reboot. And we were talking about Mary Hartman. And I said something like, that was really something, 455 episodes in 28 months. And he looked at me and he goes, no, 325. And I said, yes, I'm sorry. I was counting Forever Fernwood, the 130 episodes we did of Forever Fernwood. And he looked at me and he goes, refresh my memory? And it wasn't because he was like a doddering old fool. He literally produced so many things, he forgot we went on for a year after Louise left. He was
Wow.
like, yeah. And I said, Shelley Fabre was there, and Dabney Coleman was, a big part of it. And he's like, huh.
Right. I mean, like those shows we just mentioned, everybody, like at its height, right? Some of the heights of these shows, All in the Family had a 34 share, which equals out to 21 million people. So you got Sanford and Son had a 29 share. Maude had a 24 share. One Day at a Time had a
Maude, Maude.
23. Yeah, One Day at a Time had a 23 share. The Jeffersons had a 24 share. That is more than 100 million people in any given week are all watching something. Now, a lot of those people are the same people, obviously, but nevertheless, that is an
Eyeballs.
enormous reach to come from 1 minute. Now, of course, Norman Lear wasn't writing and directing and producing all of it, but he was undoubtedly the godfather of it all. And I mean, that's the reason why I mentioned in the intro that he hosts Saturday Night Live when he was a TV showrunner. Nobody knew who TV showrunners were back in the day, but he was that famous that he could host the show when it was at the apex of its hipness. That's who he was. That's just astounding.
It is, and Google is telling me that there were roughly 215 million people that lived in the United States in
There you
1975.
go. Right. So you're talking, what, 40% of all the Americans available to watch television are watching a Norman Lear show at
Yes,
one
somewhere
point?
between 80 and 85 million people every week tuning into his shows.
Right.
And
That's
somehow he couldn't sell Mary Hartman to the networks. They would not touch that with a 10-foot pole. No, they would not. And that's why when we became a screaming success hit, that's why ABC cranked out soap.
right. Oh, right.
They passed on it. I mean, look at it. Soap is like ditzy, redheaded. They cribbed a few storylines from us. And when I was a kid, it was really, that was an issue for me. To the point, I can honestly say, I've never watched an episode of it.
So how hands-on was he when Mary Hartman was in production? I mean, were you seeing him on the set every day? I mean, he could only do so much. I know it's all doing on the lot, but I mean, when he's got six shows on simultaneously, there's only so many places he can be.
Right. And I think he had a couple. There was Hot L. Baltimore, All That Glitters. I mean, let's not forget he had a few that also didn't make it.
Sure,
So
sure.
he had, I think, 10 shows in production at one time.
Dear Lord.
And also, if you can look up All That Glitters, that was an interesting show, so far ahead of its time. It was a show where it was a universe where women were in control and men were the like stay at home and the secretaries, and the men were getting slapped on the butt and the women were in charge. And Linda Evans played the f what I think was the first trans person that wasn't played for a joke on TV. And so yeah, he was really, really reaching out there. He had a lot of irons in the fire, and he was really involved with the show basically November and December of 1975. And then other things called, and he wasn't on, and I was like, what happened to Norman? So KTLA, where we taped, was across the street from KTTV, and that was where Norman had an office there, and he also had an office at CBS Television City, and he spent a lot of time because that's where they filmed All in the Family. And at that point, All in the Family was a money printing press.
Yep.
It was so huge. And at Christmas, Norman rented out two ballroom, the all the ballrooms in the Century City over near the oh, and the whole thing in Century City. It was these enormous ballrooms, and it was everybody from all of his shows.
Oh, that's see, I was going to ask you that, whether there was a sense of greater community among all of his productions or whether you were just sort of siloed off with your Mary Hartman people. But so there was, you got to intermingle with everyone from his shows.
Yes, but that was usually at the parties. Norman loved giving parties, so there'd be half a
Okay.
dozen of those a year. But where we were at KTLA, KTLA was Mary Hartman didn't have a big budget, and other things that were filming on Mary Hartman on the lot where we filmed at KTLA were things like Bowling for Dollars. And we also had the Donnie and Marie show. And I could go on for a very long time. There was a hilarious story, but eventually they and their pre-recorded soundtrack were so loud and it bled through these old crappy stage walls. They ended up having to move to another stage that was freestanding that didn't bother anybody else. And it was like a madhouse because Donny Osmond was bigger than God at that point. And you'd like leave work for the night and there'd be women standing around the exit of the lot. And they'd all be just like, oh, you're nobody. So these were not high budget. There was nothing that was high budget.
Okay.
Sha-na-na, What's Happening. So yeah, we won Bob Hope special. I mean, so and a lot of telethons. So we weren't at KTTV, which was across the street, which is where One Day at a Time, Facts of Life. There we go, Facts of Life. That was the other one. And there was a cafeteria, a commissary over at KTTV, and we'd go over there for lunch a couple times a week. And on my way back from lunch, if I saw Norman's yellow Mercedes, lemon yellow Mercedes, parked by the building, I knew he was there in his office. And I'd run up the couple, the second floor and bolt through. And if he was on the phone and it was a big deal, he'd, like wave at me and, I see you. And I'd leave. But if it, nine times out of 10, he'd, open his arms up and I'd run over and give him a big hug and he'd
Oh.
ask me about what I was doing and how it was going. And he'd send me on my way with some toy that someone had left him. My favorite was the shrieking monkey that has the symbols and was like, ah! And oh boy, did my cats love that. The old waterfall tic-tac-toe where you'd press on it and the water would make the little balls move. And he was very, very, very kind to me. And eventually, he found out that I was writing, that I have my like, and he's like, well, make sure you have a notebook. So I carry my notebook all around. And I'd show my notebook and I'm like, look at that. And, he had a Selectric, an IBM Selectric typewriter delivered to my schoolroom at the beginning of the school year when we were going into season two. And I opened the door, and I don't think anybody can understand unless you're a fossil like me. An IBM Selectric was more expensive than most computers cost right now.
Yeah, that was a top of the line model at the time.
Right. And those things were just sitting around. And there was like a little note, and there was a bunch of correcting tapes, no whiteout, thank you, and a bunch
Sure.
of typewriter ribbon. And it was like, when you run out, tell the production office you need more, was the note. And I learned how to type. And because of being able to learn how to type, I learned how to write faster and kind of keep up with the thoughts in my head. And when you ask about my relationship with him, I am eternally grateful to him for listening to me talk about writing, encouraging me to write, helping me by giving me the tools to write like a professional. And when I was 16, I was able to take this class with Oliver Haley, who was he was one of the developers of the show, and he was there for the first several months and then went on to different projects. And he had this writing course in the old Debbie Reynolds studios. They tore down. And it was when Debbie was just holding everything together and sleeping in her car, and she was renting out any practice space for just to get money coming through. And I remember having these classes in these giant dance studios, and I used to take dance class there too. But I'd go there for the, I was there sometimes 4 or 5 days a week at her studio. And Oliver's classes were twice a week, like 7 to 9, Tuesday and Thursday. And Brett Summers and Oliver, or Charles Nelson Reilly, who were thicker than thieves, were two of the people that there were like six of us in this class.
Wow.
And they were like, and they expected me to be respectful, and they expected me like to actually do the work, and I was happy that, like, yay, someone's taking me seriously. And of course, that writing was what I was able to use as a stand-up comic, and then as a talk show host, the voracious reading, I could do all kinds of prep, and the writing was, it's something I've been doing for more than 50 years. And I attribute his encouragement, because I sure as hell wasn't getting any at home. So I was very proud when I could tell him back when I saw him last, like I said, when I last got a hug, I'm like, look at all the, I'm gonna brag. I won all these awards for excellence in journalism. And that was, a proud moment for me. And when we were walking down the hall to his office, we went by the writer's room, and there was this burst of laughter, and they were just laughing and laughing and laughing. And I was like, oh, wow, that's a healthy writer's room. Because it wasn't like cruel laughter. It was somebody said something very funny, and like somebody added to it, and they laughed even harder. And I'm like, that's a healthy writer's room. And he was a very, very encouraging man, and I'm sure he touched hundreds of lives. And there's not one person that has come back and said, "Ooh, he was an old creep and he felt me up," or any of that stuff,
Thank
So
goodness. Thank goodness.
he's exactly. And the only person that has spoken ill of Norman waited until he was dead, and that was Sally Struthers. And she and Norman had it, there was bad blood between them because some contract thing. I'm not going to pretend to know what
Right.
it was, but she didn't even speak for herself. She didn't even say he bullied me or he did that. She said, well, he was really awful to Carol and he stole ideas from him, something Carol O'Connor never said himself. So it's like, oh, well, that's really brave. You're saying one dead guy stole from the other dead guy. Trust me on this. Neither, and the dead guy that was supposedly stolen from never made a peep about that. And he wasn't a shrinking violet.
No, yeah, no. And he worked with Norman Lear for how, what, a decade? I
Yeah,
mean,
he worked for him for a really long time through, like several iterations of Archie Bunker. And in the end, Archie Bunker was an understanding person, which is there's a scene in All in the Family where Archie gets the chance to do a rebuttal on the news about handguns. And I will be damned if every single thing he says back then, 50 years ago, isn't exactly the crap that people recite with a straight face now.
Oh, well, I mean, as much as I would love to keep asking you more and more and stuff about before we even talk about the movie, because it leads perfectly into Cold Turkey, because there is
Yes.
stuff in Cold Turkey that is as if it was written a week ago. And it is
Yeah. Yes.
startling, right? And this is a movie that Norman made in 1969. It sat on the shelf for 2 years, as I mentioned in the intro.
Do you know why they released it when they released it?
I have to assume it's because by that point he was Norman Lear at that point.
Yes, they were absolutely trying to cash in on because
Sure.
he was Norman Lear.
Yeah.
January 1st. In 1970, Congress passed a law that went into effect on January 1st, 1971, that prohibited any further advertisement on radio or
Cigarettes, right?
television for cigarettes.
Right.
So this was 6 weeks after that law started, and it was a big deal. I remember people barking, well, and that was the very, we didn't know it now, that was the very beginning of the tide changing for smoking. And so they were trying to piggyback off that after, like letting it sit there for 2 years because they didn't know what to do with it. And the instant they thought they could make a penny at it, they're like, yeah, there we go.
Now, perfect, right? I mean, one of the reasons I thought this was so fascinating, other than like I already mentioned earlier, I just wanted to talk to you on the show. I just wanted to have this conversation with you. But is that, when on the show, we've generally been talking about people who've had long careers or, somewhat of a, maybe a handful of films, either as a director or a performer. We've only to this point ever done one other episode where we're talking about someone who did one film and that was it. And that was the episode we did last year on Charles Laughton, who was, of course, a famous actor, but was did one film as director, Night of the Hunter, produces this masterpiece, never directs again. But the reason for that is because that film was poorly received at the time. It was a giant financial disaster. Now, of course, history has been kind to it, and people now recognize it for the masterpiece that it is. But at the time, it was a giant flop, and it pretty much soured Charles Laughton on ever wanting to do another movie ever again. This is a very different case because, for people who don't really know this stuff, people generally don't get a chance to direct unless they have the sort of the heat under them to get it done. Right. They have some power to get it done. Now, Norman talks. I'm going to, for, I shouldn't call him Norman because I don't know him, but for the sake of just shortening and not saying Norman Lear every time, he talks about.
He belonged to all of us.
Well, okay. I still feel, a little like, who am I to call him Norman? But he talks about this in his autobiography, which he published a bunch of years ago. Even this, I get to experience. It's called, I read it.
Yes, I got it right
And
there.
he talks about that he had a two-picture deal with United Artists, and they had done this film, A Night at Minsky's, which he was involved in. He didn't produce it, and the United Artists was so happy with it. And he's talking to the head of the studio, David Picker, and they're talking about Cold Turkey, and they're sort of talking about who should direct it. And apparently, David Picker said, "Why don't you direct it?" Which is unheard of nowadays. Unheard nowadays, all sorts of other people have to leverage all sorts of power to get it. But it was that kind of loose, and they were like, "Okay, let me go off and direct." And so he goes and he does this, and it's only because he becomes such a massive success in television that he really doesn't ever get to have a film career because the film got released in January 30th, 1971, as we mentioned. It was not a huge hit, but it was not a flop. It made some money. And so he could have continued to have a film career, I think, if he had wanted to, but it was only because he was simply striking gold every place he dug on television that he only got to do this one film. Now, for those of you who haven't seen Cold Turkey, maybe by the time you hear this, it won't be on Amazon Prime anymore for free. But I'm going to tell you, this is a really good movie. This is a really good movie. And it really is like, wow. It's got all the Norman Lear social commentary that you would expect from his television shows, but it's got more to it because it's a feature film. It's got a slightly darker edge to it that I would suggest in some of his other, his TV work. Obviously, TV, you've got to kind of have nicer characters that you want to come back to every week. The film doesn't have that. But this is a really good movie. And it is sort of like, wow, what would have been interesting if he had gone on to do other films, because this is really solid.
Now, I'm gonna interject here. He had an absolute for what was gonna be like He was the executive producer of Fried Green Tomatoes, of Spinal Tap, of Princess Bride.
Sure, the Rob a lot of the Rob Reiner stuff, sure.
Right. A lot of Rob Reiner stuff. And at the same time, all this stuff is going on. He's the executive producer for Facts of Life, 200 episodes, Silver Spoons, and these are uncredited. 100 and some odd of Silver Spoons. Well, everything else is going on. And he's saying, yeah, I think that's a good movie. I think that's a good movie. And yeah, I mean, what I wonder what we missed him not getting back behind the lens and directing.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to give a very brief plot synopsis so people, I'm not going to give anything away because, like I said, if you haven't seen this movie, you should go watch it. But I'm just going to give just a brief idea of what's going on. So, as part of a marketing ploy to better their public image, the Valiant Tobacco Company comes up with a challenge to any city or town that can give up smoking, aka cold turkey, for a month. If they do, they will win $25 million. The tobacco company figures they can't lose since they can't imagine anyone being able to actually give up smoking. But the economically depressed town of Eagle Rock, Iowa, led by the charismatic and ambitious preacher Clayton Brooks, tries to get his flock to do just that. Through persuasion, bribery, and even threats of violence, he gets the whole town to sign the pledge, but that leads to even more vices taking over the citizenry. In turn, the man behind the idea, ad exec Merwin Wren, realizes to his horror that Eagle Rock might just pull this off and heads there to see what he can do to sabotage the very plan he set in motion. Dick Van Dyke plays Reverend Clayton Brooks. Bob Newhart plays Merwin Wren. Edward Everett Horton, the great Edward Everett Horton, in his final film, plays the decomposing head of the tobacco company, Hiram Grayson. Pippa Scott plays Reverend Brooks's wife, Natalie. Bernard Hughes plays Dr. Proctor. Vincent Gardenia plays Mayor Wappler. Jean Stapleton, of course, Edith Bunker, plays Mrs. Wappler. Tom Poston plays the local town rich guy, Edgar Stopworth. Graham Jarvis, of course, from Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, plays a sort of John Birch Society type guy named Amos Bush. And the legendary comedians Bob and Ray appear multiple times as different TV anchors. And this is also based on an unpublished novel called I'm Giving Them Up for Good. And I will say, I watched this movie decades ago when I worked at a video store because of the cast. Right, I didn't know that Norman Lear was involved in it. I just knew it was like, oh wow, Bob Newhart and Dick Van Dyke and like Bob and Ray. That sounds fantastic. And I watched it, and I remembered I enjoyed it, but I didn't think much about it. Past I remember thinking it was a little silly, and I maybe didn't fully get all of it. And okay, but it was fine, and I sort of just went on with my life. And then
It
when we,
reflected the slapstick of the era sometimes, you know, like earlier and maybe, you know, the late 60s slapstick, because it was done in the late 60s.
right. And so then we decide to do this episode. So I go down and I rewatch it. And I'm like, wow, there's a lot more to this than I remembered. And then I watched it a second time and I caught even more stuff. And then I rewatched it a third time and I caught even more stuff to this movie. And this is, it's got all of the Norman Lear social satire, it's got all the Norman Lear's kind of earmarks of like, caring for his characters, but also seeing them very clear-eyed for who they are and all of their foibles. And it's got a relatively sure-footed hand at the camera in terms of its visual style, which I think is remarkable considering he was not a director. He was a producer and a writer, but it's a nice movie to look at, and it's got a consistent visual style, which again, I think is remarkable that he shows enormous facility for moving the camera around for someone who never did it before.
I 100%. He took to it. You know, he took to directing very, very well. And like you said, the look of the movie, the look of the movie goes all the way through to the last frame.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
That's what I noticed was I was like, oh, you clever man, you. Look at those. Look at those cigarettes. You know. He was very good at it. And again, you know, it's wonder what we missed, but at the same time, you know, so much great stuff that he did produce. I will note one thing that I thought was so this is 1969 when they
Right.
do this, right?
Right.
Were you as blown away as I was by who did the music?
Right. Randy Newman doing his first
Randy
ever
Newman,
score for a film.
his first ever, like, that's how good Norman was. Randy Newman has done like 300 films,
Yep.
more than 300 films. He's, you got a friend in me will last forever. Man, they'll be singing that song in another 100 years. And I heard that and I was like, what? What? And yeah, so he would see, he could see somebody's value. And so yeah, so first gig for Randy Newman was this film.
The movie opens with this long tracking shot, talking, showing you what has happened to this town of Eagle Rock, and then it's become really one of these kind of classic forgotten towns. And
Right.
it has this Randy Newman song called "He Gives Us All His Love," which is a very beautiful, very haunting. It's very sad. It's surprisingly sad way to open up what will end up being, in a lot of ways, a goofy comedy. But it's very mournful, but it's incredibly memorable. I have to say, it was like all guts
Yeah.
to Norman for kind of opening the movie that way, because you're not really expecting that kind of tone right off the bat, especially with the poster where it's like wacky people grabbing a giant cigarette and stuff. But
It
it's
makes
quite
you
striking.
sad for the town because as the long shot going into town has all the old billboards that the strip club that's no longer open, the cafe that's no longer open. You go by the base that they used to have, and that's no longer open. And the town is so impoverished that Dick Van Dyke aims to get the promotion to Dearborn,
Dearborn,
Michigan.
Michigan. He's got his eyes on the prize there.
Yeah, his eye, that's how bad and sad and depressed this town is. And yeah, their services are, they are bereft of any budget.
Right, which is why he wants to get the town, because they want to win this 25 million. And of course, the whole reason the advertising agency wants to do this is because, as Bob Newhart explains to Hiram Grayson at the beginning, is that Alfred Nobel, of course, everyone knows who Alfred Nobel is, the creator of the Nobel Prize, also made $1 trillion making munitions, making explosives. So he did a lot of bad things for the world, but no one remembers that. They only remember his name, the Nobel Prize. And so Merwin Wenn is like, well, the way we're going to change the reputation of the Valiant Tobacco Company is we're going to give this town $25 million if they give up our products, which, of course, knowing nobody's going to do it. And when I was doing research for this, and I was kind of reading some contemporary reviews and some older reviews. By the way, Roger Ebert reviewed this film when it came out and gave it 4 stars at the time. Could not have been more effusive with his praise. But I saw this one, I think it was on Letterboxd. Someone made this observation that this town is like a live action The Simpsons. And it kind of is. It has that similar energy to Springfield. And another thing that visually it brings to it is Mad Magazine, if anyone who ever read that, they would know in the margins of the pages there would be these drawings by Sergio Aragonés, who would do little gags in the in-betweens of the panels, aside from all the stuff going on in any given panel. And this movie kind of has that. There's scenes where, of course, as the town gives up their smoking and everyone turns angry, and they start giving into all of their vices, the local quote unquote masseuse starts getting visited all the time by all the different men in the town. But there's scenes of like the public park, and there's probably 25 people in different doing all doing bits of business, right? Because everybody's
Right.
angry and surly because they're giving up cigarettes. One woman is carrying her bag of groceries and she drops it, and she gets so angry that she starts kicking the bag of groceries because she's just so frustrated. Everybody's so pissed off. And it's like, it was an enormous amount of focus for Norman Lear to keep track of all that and have all these gags going simultaneously.
And then, of course, during that scene, there's the crying man.
Which is
That's
Norman Lear, right? a guy just sitting sobbing because he is
Sobbing,
not,
just
he
sobbing.
cannot smoke any cigarettes. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So I, this is my first note. I feel like I need a window open. Watching the beginning of that movie, everyone is smoking.
Oh my God. Oh.
If you are not old enough to remember when they had smoking sections of airplanes, which is like the peeing part of the pool, you could smoke anywhere. You could smoke in elevators, you could smoke in grocery stores, you could smoke in the library, you could this is the I swear the truth. The doctor who gave us the bad news about my dad walked into the family room at the hospital, you know, when they give out the bad news. He stops at the door, pulls a pack of smokes out, does the,
Wow.
you know, had some lights went up to come tell us my dad's dying from emphysema after a four pack a day habit.
Wow.
And that was like 1990. You could still smoke in a hospital. And this was like the surgeon. And as the 80s went on, there were more and more places you couldn't smoke, and boy, smokers got pretty damned angry. It was a thing. I mean, like so many people smoked. The teachers would smoke in the teachers' lounge. At my high school, I graduated in 1981. There was a smoking section in the quad.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, first of all, every car had an ashtray and a cigarette lighter, every single one. It was
Absolutely
standard. And then
standard.
every public building had an ashtray bolted onto the wall for people to put their cigarettes. Every floor had one of those little swivel ashtrays that you dumped your cigarette. It was just part of it. And it makes me think about, like, years
How
later,
about
somebody had to
this?
go in with a screwdriver and rip all those out and
Right, rip
stuff.
all
But
those out. Do you
yeah.
remember ashtrays in toilet stalls and bathrooms? Because I do.
That I don't re I can't say I remember
Yes.
that.
And when my husband and I were moving from Denver out to San Francisco, for both of us had jobs out there, we stopped in Elko, Nevada, and we stayed at, you know, like the Cattleman Inn, and we had dinner there, and it was still, you could still, you know, they smoked inside. And we both stopped to use the facilities before eating, and we come out and I'm like, is there an ashtray in the stall where you just peed? He's like, yep.
Amazing, right? It's well, one of the things
Get
that
out.
one of the things this movie features, which is just a personal bugaboo to me, is, I mean, look, I've never smoked in my life. I've never smoked a single cigarette, so it's never been anything in my life, and I've never really had anybody in my life that smoked, so it's not anything I've ever had to deal with. Although I will say, my older sister smoked like a chimney, and it helped kill her in her mid-50s. So that is the closest I've dealt with it. And
Lived my dad and my brother, who were both chimneys. Dad made it to 59, and my brother, after his massive stroke, I think he made it to 62.
yeah, I mean, my sister, I think I'm about the age that my sister was when she passed away, and she looked much older than her age, and it's because she smoked
See,
like a chimney.
people talk about how much older folks looked
Yeah.
back then. They're like, oh my
Yep.
God, everybody was so much older. Everybody smoked, and a whole bunch of those actors grew up during the Depression when no one was getting proper nutrition.
Right. Yeah, and you all
And
these deep
that's the,
lines in your
you know,
faces and stuff. Right.
right.
But one of the things that it features in this movie, other than the fact people are just smoking constantly. By the way, in his book, Norman Lear talks about that he was smoking constantly when he wrote the movie, and he's aware of the irony of that he's smoking like a chimney while he's writing this treatise about not smoking. But
Not smoking.
there is scenes of people putting their cigarettes out in their food, which
Yes.
makes me retch. There is something so disgusting about shoving your stinky cigarette in food. It also feels very wasteful, of like, you're just so
Disrespectful to the cook.
disrespectful of the food that you're just like good stubbing it. I mean,
Disrespectful of the food and the effort put into it, because I
yes.
really like to cook. I'm pretty good, but I when I cook, it's the proverbial with love and a lot of
Right.
care.
Yes.
And I got a new toy today. I got a mandolin. I was like slicing up potatoes about an hour before this. But I very much understand the effort that people go, you know, to go through to feed other people, and that to put out
Stub
your
your
cigarette
cigarette,
in
yeah.
somebody's food means that the person who cleans up that plate has to deal with it.
Yes,
And it's all
yes.
disgusting. It's very, very
It's so
disrespectful.
gross.
It's super screw you.
Yeah, oh, it really is. And so he really gets to, he really puts that across. Now, I mentioned earlier when you were talking about how some of the stuff, you know, Archie Bunker's speech about guns could be written today. I mentioned Graham Jarvis, who of course was on Mary Hartman, Mary
Yes,
Harbin.
he was salt of the earth. You could not find a nicer man
Oh,
than
that's
Graham.
wonderful to
He was
hear.
and loved his wife and loved his children, and just a lovely, lovely soul.
I'm very happy to hear that. Here he plays, as I mentioned, this guy Amos Bush, who is the head of the Christopher Mott Society, which again is sort of like a John Birch thing. His little group basically wants to make Eagle Rock great again, essentially. And there's
It really, really reflects politics, because he has like this fringe group of people. There might be
Yes.
30 people that listen to him,
Yep.
but they can't get everybody in town has to sign the pledge. And they
And
refuse
right.
to sign the pledge, even though they don't smoke.
Yes.
They
Yeah,
refuse
like
to
that's the scene.
still can't tell me what to do.
That is
And
that
then
was the that was the moment where
when
the Reverend Brooks is like, your
he's like,
people
you don't
don't
even
even
smoke.
smoke. Why won't you sign it? He goes, I just don't like being
So
told what to do. And you're like,
old, I don't
oh
like
my
being
God,
told what to do.
was this written last year? Like, what's happening? And of course, he.
And then when an important little thing is that he's like, well, can we, you know, well, what are you gonna give me? And we're like, hey, you can make sure that everybody's, you know, doing what they're supposed to do. And he's like, oh, can I wear an arm badge and a cap? Or, you
Yep.
know.
He wants an armband and a hat. The minute he gets to be the enforcer, then he immediately turns his opinion on the whole thing, and they're all for it. It's amazing.
And
The minute you give
here's
him a
my
taste of
note.
power, that's it. That's
Right.
all that he wants.
Graham Jarvis goes from wanting a cap and an armband, because it is just a cap. It's like almost like a like what you'd see at a service station, you
Yep.
know, or
Yeah.
an in and out, you know.
Right.
And you
Right.
know, he goes from wanting a cap and an armband to stopping cars from bringing, you know, in tobacco to becoming like a full-blown fascist with a horse and a uniform and black boots and a gun and a diagonal strap across his
Yep.
chest. And like every iteration, every time you see him through the movie as it goes on, he's like more and more goose stepping,
Yep.
and
Yep.
you know, and they're literally stopping cars, and I'm like, oh my God, this is so current.
It's unreal, right? You watch it and you're like,
Yes.
when was this? What? This movie's 50, 60, almost 60 years old, and you're like, this is right out of where we're living right now.
Right out
It's
of
just, it's
right.
unbelievable. And you're like, on the one hand, it's like, it's startling. And on the other hand, it isn't, because you're like, well, we've just always dealt with these people. I mean, that's what Frank Burns on MASH is. It's the same idea. And it's like, these people have always been around. But to see it portrayed so wonderfully, both on the page by Norman Lear and then by Graham Jarvis as the actor, is just like, oh, there it is. There it
We
is.
always had loonies in talk radio. Always had the loonies. And I would explain to them, you can be a loony once a week. And that was it. We had like, that was what my mentor had, a strong, you do not have the loonies on, because first of all, we don't give them that much oxygen. And second of all, it's not funny. It's just, it gets old. So
Right.
some people will call up and I'd be like, okay, 90 seconds starts now.
Right.
Get through it. I go, okay, you're done. See you next week. And that's how we would deal with the loonies. And now they can just like post their manifesto on the internet, 24 hours a
Yeah, now
day.
it's a YouTube, now it's a nonstop YouTube channel.
Right now it's a YouTube channel with monetization.
Yeah. One of the other things I noticed about why, again, watching it, first of all, one thing I just noticed after the fourth time, which I'm ashamed to admit, I didn't notice it till the fourth time, was that Reverend Scott's wife, played by Reverend Brooks, excuse me, his wife, Pippa Scott, is the actor.
Scott, yeah.
I did not notice until the last time I just watched it that she does not actually speak until 1 hour into the movie. She almost speaks. He keeps talking over her, but I never, like, I was like, as I watched it the fourth time, I went, huh, oh yeah, that's funny. She never actually talks in this scene. And then the next scene, oh, he just tells her to stop slouching. And then, oh, he keeps
She
interrupting her.
was
And I'm like, how have I
right.
seen this film 3 times and I haven't noticed that little comedic bit? And I've only took, so I'm like, I keep watching this movie and it keeps paying dividends on me. It's like unbelievable.
And Dick Van Dyke was not a sympathetic character. He's very
No.
charismatic, but he's got like a stick up his butt, and he doesn't give a damn about people stopping smoking or
No.
vices. He's encouraging them to indulge in other vices to get through this month. And nobody has any intention of permanently quitting smoking. And he's doing all of this so he can get this great promotion to
Yep.
Dearborn, which was just like such a pit. And he does. He's a bully to his wife, and his wife, if you notice, she's like constantly smoking. And because he doesn't let her talk, he never smells her breath.
Right. She's always spraying the like
Right,
Benaca or
like
whatever in her
the
mouth. Yep.
Benaca. And yeah, and he's like under the impression that he's really affecting her life, he is not a sympathetic character. And Bob Newhart is just this evil, no good Nick.
Okay. Well,
And
that's the comparison to The Simpsons is that like Bob Newhart and Edward Horton are like Mr. Burns and Smithers. They have that same dynamic, kind of,
all
you
the way
know?
down to like how old Mr. Burns is and
Right.
Smithers' bald spot.
Exactly. By the way, I love Edward Horton. I've loved him ever since I heard him narrate Fractured Fairy Tales on the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. I've loved
I love, yes.
we talked about him a little bit a couple months ago because he was in a bunch of the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies that we talked about. If I ever do an episode of Fade Out on Edward Horton, which I want to because I love him, we'll end up talking about this movie then because this is his last film.
Right.
But I love he never gets a line. He actually never speaks.
He
He
just kind of goes, ooh, ooh.
yeah,
He just like makes little
he
noises and
gestures.
like, yeah.
Yeah, he's fully present. It's a full performance, but he never actually
He
speaks,
never
which is
actually speaks, and you
unbelievable.
get the feeling you know at one point that he has soiled himself, but he doesn't say, I pooped.
Right.
Like Norman doesn't have to go roll in it,
Yeah.
you
Oh,
don't have to
it's.
roll in poo. So, I still say Tootsie Lavendure and the Ruby Yacht of Omar Khayyam. Those are two fractured fairy tales.
I love that
And
thing so much.
I just and when I was a kid, we used to go drive on Sunset Boulevard past the life's the gigantic Bullwinkle from
Oh, the
please don't
statue, right? There was a
yeah,
statue.
right now that they have like in the middle of the road, that used to be where that was where the studio was, where they did all those, and that building had they had a bunch of people kind of do the Grauman's Chinese thing, and they were it kind of like an inside joke, but Ward, help
Jay
me with the
Ward.
name,
Jay Ward.
yes, Jay Ward, but yeah, that used to be on Sunset Boulevard, and
Oh
I
man, oh, I'd love
I
to
used to
see
go
that.
by it, and it was a that statue was making fun of a billboard across the street, and the billboard across the street was for the Stardust, I think it was, in Las Vegas, and they had this rotating woman in boots and like a bathing suit, and it was the advertisement, go to Las Vegas, and So they did this huge statue right across the street because they were so irreverent. So you'd be driving along and there'd be Bullwinkle on the left side and the billboard with the rotating woman with boots, and yeah, you could look it up. It's really pretty
That's
funny.
fantastic. It's
They were just hilarious.
perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Just absolutely perfect. So one
Yes.
other thing about the movie that I wanted to see what you thought of, because as I noticed it, is that it is for a guy who, well, first of all, it's very adept. The movie is very adept at blending in television, how television manipulates things, how just something being
Yes.
on television manipulates things. And that's not surprising that Norman Lear would show some facility with that, because obviously he worked in television. But it also is very, very skewering of television, which is a little, I don't want to say a little surprising, but it's for a guy who made his fortune in television, it is literally kind of like biting of the hand that feeds you. There's this marvelous scene where Dick Van
Phantom
Dyke
Light.
is jogging and he gets stopped by Mayor Wappler, played by Vincent Gardenia, and he's like, "Hey, they're mentioning our town on the air. Come on this morning show. Come on in and sit here and watch it. When it comes back from commercial, they're going to talk about us." And they run like three commercials in a row, and Norman Lear makes you sit through all the ads, and you hear Mayor Wappler like, "Okay, all right, you know." Then they come back, and I think it's Ray. No, it's Bob. It's Bob Elliott is the host, and he's got Bob Newhart on his show, and he goes, "Well, we're back. And now we're going to have a word from our sponsor." And then they cut to another ad,
Yep.
and the mayor's like, "Oh my God."
When
And then they come back again and they do it again. And it's this thing, this
Western
comedy
radio,
of this wonderful comedy of frustration of
right.
like, that's what television is going to make you sit through nine ads to get for 30 seconds of the content you want. And I was like, I thought that was all that stuff was more, and all the Bob and Ray stuff where they play multiple TV hosts. They play a parody of Walter Cronkite.
And at that time, his name was Walter Cronick, and that
Walter
was a
Cronick,
pretty inside baseball term for weed at the time. Cronick was not a term that they used. I do want to say when I was in radio, we would sometimes when I was running my own show, I would have to really push back on the amount of ads. And I used to joke, I'm like, so are we going to sponsor this time check or this time check brought to you by, and the other one I would ask is, are we going to start selling ads for tornado warnings? They would just shove them in everywhere, and there's a Simpsons joke about that, which is there are 11 things under your sink that can kill you coming up at 11.
Right. Yeah, exactly right. It's the movie, and in terms of its editing, like it's the rhythmic editing of how television
Yes.
works. And I mean, there's again, Bob Elliott plays there's this bit where he plays like a Chet David kind of like a Chet Huntley kind of
David
guy.
Entley.
David,
Yeah,
yeah,
I wrote
David
these names
Brinkley.
down because I thought they were so funny because David Bentley, David Entley, and really took them down a peg. And Norman used a technique that Woody Allen made an entire movie called Zelig out of. They do a smash cut 15 minutes into the film, and they use news footage of Nixon and Reagan
That's
and
right. Yes.
whole
Spiro
bunch of.
Agnew and right, all
Right,
these
and they're all
people. Yeah.
going, I think this is a really good idea.
Right.
And that had never been done before,
That's
where
right.
they took actual news archival footage and then passed it off as they're all saying, like, I think this is a great idea to quit smoking.
It's
Yeah.
much like his television work, it's expecting more of the audience to keep up. To keep
Yes.
intellectually keep up with the style and keep up with
Yes.
the rhythms of it. And I was
Yes.
really impressed by that. And that is why watching this, I just say, wow, this really is of a piece with his TV work. It is probably a little more cynical. The ending, which I won't reveal, is pretty dark. And in
Yeah.
fact, he even talks about it again in his book about how it required an optical effect. That at that point the studio had let go all of their optical people, and he was like, "David, I need people," and so they had to like bring all these people back, especially just to do this one pretty grand optical shot, which again shows a visual understanding of how movies work, which I think is impressive for someone who spent his whole time just doing not just but just doing television. But yeah,
And there's
it
so many throwaways that
yeah.
The call letters for the radio station.
Oh, when he's
W
when,
W O M B.
yeah, when Ray is doing the kind of like religious guy, yeah, and he's W
He
from W
quit.
O M
And I'm
B.
just like, and that was 1971, was the height of Roe versus Wade. So, he just packed all these visuals into it. And so I have notes and stuff. One of my notes is close-ups of some awful teeth.
Oh, yeah.
But all of the media changes, you mentioned this, the media attention completely changes everyone and the town
Yep.
to the point that they are televising the church service. And they do the pullback and the long sweep, and it's slowly going across the congregation. And Dick Van Dyke starts into his sermon, and you hear "Ho!" which is something that I was just like, oh, because that was what I'd hear, and you'd be like, ah, who moved? Who gave a shadow? And you realize it's not live. They're going to edit this.
Yep.
And then they give everybody instructions, and then the congregation, they're like, okay, we want to make, be happier. And they look like lunatics. Like they're like smiling into the camera because it's like, there's a camera there. And that was damn near 60 years ago. And all the things where they do, where all the different comments they're making about the news. One of the things I hear people talk about, there was a scene in Mary Hartman that was at the Chinese laundromat. It's very convoluted. Heather sees a mass murder. The mass murder kidnaps her. Mary takes her place. That's the short version. Outside of the Chinese laundromat, there's no nothing. There's no update, right? It's just the same thing over and over again. It's a standoff. And these two reporters are there from two different stations, and they start interviewing each other on the air. They're interviewing each other about what they saw. Oh my God, how could he have known what 24-hour news was going to be like? People out interviewing the storm. Hey, why don't you go out there and stand in some seawater and see if some fish will hit you? And that's what we call in the business interviewing the storm. It's absolutely useless. But hey, let's go out to Brett in the parking lot dodging pieces of metal.
Yeah, it's I think again, for anyone who hasn't watched it, I think if you watch it the first time, there is a lot of broad humor, there's a lot of slapstick, there's an end, the very end, which features some physical violence that I don't think quite lands. I think it's a little too cartoony, and it doesn't quite
Yes.
I think he doesn't quite get there in the last part of the film. But I think if you watch it and you're not paying full attention, which of course is easy to do in this day of watching everything at home and you're streaming and you're putting a movie on and then you get up to get yourself a drink or put the laundry
Next
away.
laptop going, oh my God, did you see what they did? Okay, anyway, I'm looking at the TV.
Yeah, like
We
you're
run that
right,
back.
exactly. I think you can mistake the broadness as kind of like, oh, okay, it's that kind of movie. But I think if you actually give it your full attention, the satire seeps in and you start, and as I did, you start going, wow, there is a lot more to this than it first seems like there is. And
There are a lot of messages about capitalism,
oh my
about
God, yeah.
fascism, about how the news makes a dog and pony show of everything. And this was 1971. This is another one of, this is a note that I directly, like, that's what I saw. And the cravenness of, so the town is barely making it. It's kind of baling wire and duct tape and chewing gum holding it all together. And everyone, the hospital is very old, and everyone's doing their best with what they have. And at the first hint that there might be more money, there might be, money for a budget, everybody comes but before they've even like won the contest, right? They're already spending the money. And they're like, all of a sudden, like the librarian wants a 10 or $1 billion library, and the doctor wants a $4 million hospital, and everybody wants to spend more than they possibly can. Like suddenly they don't want enough money to make things continue and get a little better. Everybody wants their pet
Their
project,
pet project,
their
yes.
pet project taken care of. And then, I mean, stop me if it doesn't sound like right now, they're still talking about like, okay, we might get this $25 million, and the town elders have 50 million ways to spend it. And then somebody gets up and says, well, I don't know why we can't all just have $6,000.
Emmett Walsh, the great character actor, Emmett
Right,
Walsh
Emmett Walsh,
is the guy
yes,
that makes
he's
that
25.
pitch,
Why can't
yes.
we have like we all have $6,000? Which is like, no, you need a hospital, you need street lights, you need an ambulance. You know, they actually have needs that they could spend this on, and everybody wants to piss the money away. The instant they get a few bucks in their pocket, they want to piss it away. And I'm like, did we learn nothing in my lifetime?
No, well, the answer to that,
That is what's
unfortunately, is no. But
I was
yeah,
five when this movie was filmed. I was 5 years old when this movie was filmed, and I'm sitting here going, this could be today.
really could be. I mean, I love the what's the crossing guard who
Yes.
only does a favor for the Reverend because he's going to get her a burial plot at the church when the time comes. Like, it's like they're all cutting corners and
Everything's
they're all making
transactional.
side deals and all this stuff. It's un
It
and it all goes by so fast.
And it's transactional before transactional was a buzzword.
Yes, it really is. It really is. And
And
so it's the kind of thing where like it is a little, again, I think it's a little more cynical than his TV work, but I think that's just the nature of the beast. I just think you
I
obviously
didn't
can
know I
be.
was on Mary Hartman. I thought that was pretty damn
Well, that's
cynical.
true. But I mean, even like Archie Bunker, if, even with as many flaws as Archie Bunker has, the show still loves him and it wants him to get better, as opposed to the
Right.
movie, which is sort of presenting these people as okay. And but you know what? In a
Yes.
funny way, though, it's Norman Lear being very respectful of small town life because he is showing them to be the same as everybody else. They have their own flaws, they have their own. It's not one of those movies where some person out in Hollywood is
They're taking
those.
advantage of the rubes. No,
Yeah,
they're
and
everybody's selfish.
yeah, right. It's like,
And everybody's in it for themselves, you
yeah,
know?
it's presenting them as people, like they're flawed like everybody else. And I,
Yes.
in a lot of ways, that's actually more respectful of the people than presenting them as, oh, well, small town folk are really the salt of the earth. Well, no, there's salt of the earth everywhere. There is salt of the earth kind of people in the cities. There's salt of the earth people in the country. There's salt of the earth people in the suburbs. And there's also terrible people in all those places. What
Okay.
one area of this country does not have the patent on being salt of the earth. And I think he gets that across in this movie. And I could see why that may be the movie could be easily misconstrued as always making fun of small town. No, he's really not. He's really
No.
not. He's showing them for the flaws that they have and what will happen, what could happen to you when your one vice is stripped away and the potential for fame and money come flooding in, what it can
Right.
do to you.
And it also shows on a micro level what happens on a macro level with budgets, where everybody tends to, you have different factions. And some people want to spend the money for, you know, even the guy who, the doctor who wanted a new updated hospital wanted a ridiculous, like, oh, let's have the Taj Mahal. You know, there was never just enough, right? So yes, it wasn't making fun of these people for being rubes. It was pointing out that it was pointing out how greed basically makes people ignore when things are bad for them, whether it's smoking or drinking or the military industrial complex or the news. Any of those things. It was a commentary of how people are fallible, and it doesn't matter where you are. And yeah.
It's a really special movie. He mentions it in again in the book. He says the 8 weeks I spent shooting Cold Turkey remains a highlight of my life. So he had a really good time making
And
it,
they
which
opened
is
the movie in Iowa
right. And because it
when it
was that's
opened,
where they
yeah.
shot it. Right. Yeah,
Right.
exactly.
And they gave them the credit, and they gave them the respect and opened it there, which wasn't a thing that they did. So, because it wasn't like you could simulcast it or live stream it or any of that stuff. It was so yeah, that I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to, because at the beginning I thought, this looks a little slapsticky, but it's more the time. I mean, that was look, you're looking at the same era as like Doctor Strangelove, and it's a mad, 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 mad world where things were very big and slapstick then. And
And it said, and it does have all that. It had, according to you mentioned, you kind of referred to this earlier, but and it mentioned this in the on the Wikipedia page, like. It has probably, I think what film historians consider the first fart joke in the history of cinema, which is the Edward Everett Horton thing in the limo. And so it's like it's got broad comedy, but then it has all of this incisive commentary about greed and about television and about the media and about
right.
religion and how all that can get corrupted. And it has all of that in an hour and 40 minutes. Which, and it's written by him too. I mean, not directed by it, but written by him as well. I mean, it's a remarkable achievement. And so one last thing I found this quote about the movie, and I just thought it was instructive about how when you're just trying to create something good, right? Some of the people you're up against in ways. So anyway, this is the quote I found about this movie. It is from a United Artists executive named Arthur Krim. And he was later commenting on this movie. And it says he later assessed the film during an evaluation of the company's inventory. Quote, an old commitment to Dick Van Dyke and what seemed to be a good idea for the American market became an overpriced film with a has-been personality by the time of its release. Albeit funny, the picture is way overpriced for its value, which is strictly for the American market, mainly for mid-America. The producer and director went over $1 million over budget on the film to deliver a minor American comedy with no overseas value. This film would be programmed today only if it could be made at one half the cost. Unquote. It's like the guy might as well be talking about tape recorders, right? Or cigarettes. It's just product. It's just a piece of cheese that just moves down the line. And I'm like, imagine all the artistry that goes into making a movie. You just want to make your movie good. And you're dealing with guys like this who are just looking at these things that way. Like, that's kind of.
Couldn't do, they couldn't freaking carry his jock strap, and they're like, no.
Guys like that see the cost of everything and the value of
The
nothing, you
value of
know?
nothing.
So
Exactly.
it's like.
Exactly. And again, I wish he had directed more, but I am so thrilled for what he did give us.
I mean, look, movies lost, cinema's loss was TV's gain because he went on to this amazing, and he got to produce thousands of hours of television as opposed to slugging it out to just make one movie. But it really is a lot of times when you if you read somebody's IMDb and you say, oh, they only made one movie, oh, that must be a stinker. No. That's not always the case. Sometimes it's just circumstances are against them. And in this case, he just went off on a rocket ride and another whole career, and it remains this singular thing. But it holds up amazingly well. So if
He
anyone
was
listening to this, if you haven't
also
seen it, see it.
take the time to do it. He was also and I just had my train of thought jump the track there. As I was saying, be sure to see it. I'm sure the idea will come back around. I interrupted myself.
It leads into what I kind of wanted to wrap this up with, because I want to go back to your relationship with Norman, because again, we could keep talking about this for hours and hours and hours, and we got to keep the show from going becoming 5 hours long.
Big and boring.
No, not at all. I just it's you know I it's like I'm just there's so much stuff again I'm going to continue to talk to you about, but the exit question for you is, and I just again I want to bring this back to your relationship with Norma. Can you give us an example of just either in a small way or a larger what it was like to work with Norman Lear? Because I you know as time goes on, we don't have that many people still with us that can say what it was like to work with. I mean, like think of the TV showrunners that the star showrunners that exist today, the Greg Berlantes or the Tyler Sheridans or the Shonda Rhimeses, who produce multiple shows. All their shows combined don't have a viewership of one of his shows, right? You take every Tyler Sheridan show combined, and it's half of what One Day at a Time did.
Right.
So
And
the
somebody brought up to me recently about how many people watched Mary Hartman. And I was like, well, we weren't like a ratings powerhouse. We were a cult show. And this person said to me, oh my dear, if you had that many people watching you every night, that now, today, if
Oh.
you had as many people that watched you every night, do you have any idea what a you would be? There isn't a show on television that has as many viewers as you had every night at 11 o'clock.
Oh, it would be the
Yes.
TV executives are flipping out when shows get a two share, right? They're like, "Oh my God, a two share." And now
Right.
All in the Family was getting a 30
Did
share.
you
I
say?
mean,
Yeah, it was one out of every three people, and
yeah.
keep in mind, some of these people were like, had no televisions. It meant everybody in the whole country,
Yeah.
and it was a big thing. It was what they called water cooler talk. The water cooler show. You'd stand there and talk about last night's
Yeah.
show.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as I understand it, with Mary Hartman, in San Francisco, the bars would turn Mary Hartman on, and the bathhouses were empty out for that half hour. And I know that I went to San Francisco in the summer of 1976, and I got mobbed,
Wow.
absolutely mobbed. And I was it was before I'd hit my growth spurt, and I was a little, I was like 5 feet tall maybe, and people wanted autographs, and then they started pressing in closer and closer, and I got like separated from my family, and people were pulling pieces of my hair out and
Oh,
pinching me.
my.
And we my brothers and my dad helped me get out of the crowd, and we went into this ice cream store over near the cannery on Cannery Row, and the manager recognized me immediately and locked the door and took me out the back. And to run. He said, go that way and run, but asked for an autograph on the way back through the back. And he's un unlocking it. And he goes, I will drink free for a year on that. And I signed it for him, and it was like, and gone. And it was
Wow.
just huge, huge, huge. And he knew how to, like I said, Princess Bride, come on. Everybody, As You Wish or Turn It Up to 11 with Spinal Tap. He had an amazing eye for picking really good pieces. He knew talent, and he knew good writing, and he was a joy to work with. He
So
really
okay,
was.
well then say can get what an example of what it was like working with him. Again, we talked about how you wanted to answer this and you can answer it however you want. What is some experience you had just with him that you think is exemplifies what it was like to sit and work with this man?
I mentioned before about the typewriter, about
Right.
encouraging me to write, and that gave me a way to get out of Hollywood and to get out of there. And that meant so much to me. That's a gift, that keeps giving. But one of the things I think about him as really decent person, when Mary Hartman played, the very first night it premiered, as I mentioned, Norman had this. It was a pre-taped thing. And there were two pilots, yeah? So it was an hour-long show. And I was not in the pilots. The pilots were filmed 2 years before we went into production, 3 years. He just couldn't sell it and finally did it himself by going from two individually owned television stations, wined them, dined them, showed them it, and they believed in him and put the money into it. And So the premiere comes, and I am so excited. And we watch, and Norman talks, and the first episode goes, and the second episode goes. And then they show a teaser scene from episode three. And it had me, I think, you know, it had a brief thing of me, and it was like a little smash cut of what's coming up next on this amazing show that's on every night. And the credits rolled, and my name wasn't on them.
Oh no.
And I sat there, and I was absolutely stunned. And I don't know how many kids I had told, how many kids at school, I'm going to be on a TV show. I'm going to be on a TV show. Watch for me. Look for my name. And my name wasn't there. And it was just like, oh. And that was like a, it was like a huge spear in my heart. It was awful. It was horrible. And in the morning, I went to get the newspaper because I liked to read the comics, and I had been encouraged to be familiar with what the newspaper was by my teacher. And my brothers were paper boys, and I went and got the paper. And as I opened the front door, there was a yellow envelope in the screen door, and there were flowers and on the porch. And I still have that telegram. And that telegram was from the station manager of KTTV telling me that he had gotten a telephone call from Norman at last night, and that I apologize deeply, and it's my fault your name wasn't on the credits. And I'm literally choking up because he turned around and he cut that guy a brand new butthole and said, "You apologize to her. She is equal to everyone on that show." And there were flowers and an apology from him. And, you know, like, "Love you, Norman. Sorry, you know, sorry for the mix-up. Love you, Norman." And there was this telegram waiting for me before I went to work. And he could have like just sent flowers to the stage, but he didn't. And that meant the world to me because he saw me. That's what a wonderful man he was. He told me that my addition, that my acting and my addition to the show were important, and I was one of as equal as any member on that cast, and that gave me a lot of self-respect and confidence.
That's wonderful. And I don't even want to gummy
I
up the
want to
show
go any
by adding
further.
anything else to that. That is
Exactly.
such a wonderful, beautiful story that we're going to wrap it up here. I
Right.
mean, Claudia, I could spend a bunch more hours talking to you about these subjects because once we started interacting online, I was like, I really want to talk to this person. And I knew the show was going to be super fun to do. And I was
Absolutely.
right. And so I really very much appreciate you coming on to share your memories of working with Norman, because I imagine those are your memories. Those are precious. You are one of the handful of people on planet Earth that can say
Right.
you worked with this man. When I have someone on who has a personal experience with the subject, I always want to be careful because, again, they're your memories and they're not necessarily for everyone to hear. And but
Right.
I figured, hey, you'll if you didn't want to do the show, you could always say, no, I don't want to do the show, and it's fine.
Greg Louise and I got together last fall and we had lunch. We've done it a couple times now, and we all toasted to Norman and
Oh,
we
that's
all
fantastic.
remembered him. And it was Louise and her partner and Greg and my husband and me, and we all toasted to Norman and the amazing talent that he was.
It's fantastic. So
Yeah.
again, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. Why
Absolutely.
don't you tell people where
Absolutely.
they can find you out on the internet?
I'm on the blue sky, and I have been working like crazy on memoirs, so I haven't been really adding to my blog. But if you want to read about some of the ways it was, what it was like balancing crazy parents and being on a 5-day-a-week show. I used to be on the tweeters, but boy, did that turn into an open sewer
Yeah,
of
no,
white
we're
nationalism and
got the hell out
Nazis.
of there. Yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely.
exactly. So you, I know it is very late for you, and
Oh,
I
it's just,
appreciate.
oh,
I
piece of
used to
cake. Are
stay
you
up like
kidding? This is
midnight,
fantastic. This is
one.
I looking so forward to doing this, and this is just great. So again,
Yeah,
thank you. Thank
yeah.
you
I
so
was going
much.
to say MASH. Mary Kay Place wrote for MASH a couple times and was
Yes,
on
she
about
did.
it.
That's right.
If you want me to talk about her, she was a freaking amazing. She's such a talent.
That we will have that conversation off air. Absolutely, we'll talk about that because I would absolutely love to have you back on another one
I
of my
just
podcasts. Guaranteed.
adored Mary Kay.
Guaranteed. Oh, that sounds fantastic. So, well, anyway, thank you everybody for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of Fade Out on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. The show has its own dedicated page over on Blue Sky at Fade Out Pod. And then finally, if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. There you're going to lock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Monique D, Donald McWaters, Mark Balbus, and David S. Gutierrez and Gord Tolton for their support of Fade Out and the Fine Water Podcast Network. So thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month, but we've reached the end of this particular script. So for now, it's time to fade out.
Producer-director Norman Lear has imported a wide range of curiosities from mind-bending character actors.
Tobacco may be the noblest invention of mankind, but where does that leave the donut?
To name-droppable stars such as Bob Newhart, Pippa Scott, and Dick Van Dyke in his underwear.
Actually, this isn't underwear. This is very expensive wardrobe, which we got at Goodwill, believe it or not.
The story takes place in a typical American town. That felt like heartland America to us. So we toured all the way through the Midwest. And if you've been photographing the square in Greenfield, you may understand why, with the minute I saw Greenfield, it had to be it. It's the most unique county seat in Iowa or any of the Midwestern states we visited. They've been absolutely marvelous. I don't know what's happening with other films that are being made around the country, but this has been a romance. Cast, crew, and Greenfield, Iowa.
Greenfield, Iowa. The town that stole the show.